Esther chapter 3, verses 13 through 15. And the letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. The post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city Shushan was perplexed. Now, in the earlier part of this chapter, Haman's rise to power in the Persian Empire has been noted as reaching its zenith in his being positioned as the chief counselor of the king. In fact, later in the chapter, the idea that the signet ring, which demonstrated the legitimate exercise of power within the empire, that has now been entrusted to Haman for the purpose of enacting his designs against the Jews, further enforces this notion that Haman has, in fact, reached what we would call the zenith or the apex of his power. It's the highest point. He can't really go any higher. He's not going to take over the actual throne. He's not going to become Ahasuerus or Xerxes. But he's risen as high as anyone can in this kind of monarchical system. Now, without that signet ring, any conniving on the part of Haman would have been without the force of law. It would have been lacking what we might call a proper imposing legal authority. The signet then was the seal of that authority, which had been handed over to Haman, and it was in fact sealing the purposes of Haman. The fact that the king has removed the ring from his hand, and I talked about this before, how unusual a thing it was or would be for a king or a ruler to remove a signet ring. You understand, all of his authority is really bound up and compressed into that ring. Now, if you use that ring, you can seal anything and it becomes law. As soon as it's published, it will be law. So the fact that he removed the ring from his hand and gave it to Haman to execute his plot suggests at the very least that Ahasuerus has personally invested no small amount of trust in Haman. And in all likelihood, as I mentioned earlier, what he is trusting is, he senses in Haman someone who has an ability to defect or to blunt any future conspiracies against the king and his kingdom. Remember that story in the previous chapter about Bigthan and Teresh. The king wants to make sure that doesn't happen again. And certainly through his words now, Haman has presented a picture of what we would call an existential threat to the stability of the Persian Empire from that people he described previously, who we know are the Jews. The king doesn't necessarily know that. Now, whether consciously or not, and the Jewish rabbis thought it was conscious, in fact, they thought that Ahasuerus was, as well as Haman, a supreme anti-Semite. Ahasuerus is, conscious or not of what's going on, he's thrown in his lot with the lot of Haman, to make a little bit of a pun on what's going on here in the book of Esther. He's committed the keeping of his kingdom to a man whom we are told explicitly And in several different ways, is the Jew's supreme enemy. The guy who is identified as the supreme enemy of the Jews. And why is that important? I think that what we see herein is what we might call an instinctive hostility, which the kingdoms of this world have to the kingdom of our God and Christ on the earth. In fact, I would say, and I've noted this previously, there's almost a curious lack of curiosity regarding the identity of the people to be destroyed on the part of Ahasuerus or Xerxes. He never says, who are we talking about? You know, what are they? Where are they? All of the information he has is pretty generic. They're everywhere. They're rebels. They're coming out of the woodwork. It was the equivalent maybe of our Red Scare in America in the 40s and 50s. Except then at least we identified the people as communists. And we were trying to extirpate them. But Ahasuerus doesn't ask any questions like that. He doesn't ask who or specifically what they've done. He just takes Haman's word. And again, this points to the fact that he has supreme regard and trust in Haman. We don't know why, but very clearly he does. The lack of curiosity is especially strange, I think, since in all of this, Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, he's resigned himself to the extermination of what is going to be an entire nation or population of the empire, who have just simply been described as incorrigible rebels. Now, again, we have to remember that this contest between Haman and the Jews, from the point of view of the author of Esther, is being cast as a contest between the house of Saul and Agag. Or, if we were to put it in more primeval terms, we don't want to lose sight of this. Because in this we see that Esther really is taking up a theme that we find again and again in the Bible. And that is, we might see what's going on here as a version of this struggle that we're told would occur between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. Now here in Esther, pagan religion in the person of Haman has united itself to political power in order to destroy the people of God. And so there's a sense in which what we see going on with Haman and the king is they are the devilish counterparts, if you will, of under the Jews, what we would say would be the king and the high priest. Right? That's kind of what they really are. So that you see, church and state are in cahoots. They're working together for the destruction of the true people of God here. And we shouldn't underestimate this point, but the natural hostility of the heathen mind to the cause of God and his truth is underscored, I think, by the fact that the king dismisses Haman's offer of vast sums of money to carry out the plot. At least, I think that's what he's doing in those previous verses where he tells him that the silver or the money is his. But whatever view we take, whether the king just flatly turns down the monetary offer or he's offering Haman the spoils of the Jews to sort of repay him for what he puts into the coffers, I do think that the force of the previous verse is trying to make clear the king is not actually moved, or not particularly moved, by any pecuniary or financial concern. That's not really the first or primary concern. Is it a concern? Well, it may be. Does it fatten the coffers of the Persian Empire? Sure. is certainly if the money went in there, as we saw, it's a very large sum of money. But I think that the point of what's being said there is to make us aware that there's something bigger, something more fundamental that is, in fact, the sticking point for the king. He's not just moved by the money, and he's not primarily moved for the money. I don't think anyone should say, although I know some commentators do, but I don't think anyone should say that Ahasuerus is acquiescing in this plot for the sake of what the apostle would call filthy lucre. In fact, I would say that in that, his motives seem to be untainted, or at least perhaps a little bit more neutral. In fact, I would say that it's nothing really but an antipathy toward true religion that could really explain the far-reaching consequences of his passive support of Haman. The fact that he's not digging deeper, that he probably already has some idea who it is or the nation that is under, or there will be under this edict. And I would go a little bit further here and say that this, I think, evidences in the king a newfound reliance upon his pagan faith. Especially if we understand, as I've asserted several times now, that Haman is in some sense a representative of the fire priests of the Persian religion, who's been brought into the king's most trusted council and has risen to the place of being number one counselor, right? That tells us then that Haman, more than being moved by the money, is probably being moved by a sort of false religious devotion or sense of religious devotion. The problem with false religion and those who are devoted to it is that a mind settled in a pagan faith, in a non-Christian faith, is settled in its hostility toward the true religion, whether people realize it or not. It doesn't have to be consciously in view. It's really the de facto or default, I should say, position of that mind. Nonetheless, as I noted last time, and as we'll see again and again, the manner in which this newfound devotion flows from the king is precisely calibrated to the designs of God's providence for his people. Whether he's consciously or unconsciously aware of this conflict, everything that he does, and everything that he will do, and everything that Haman does and will do, all of this is serving the end that God has designed for his own people. And as I noted, the allowance of the use of a signet is going to make the decree at once unalterable, so that the violent intention that is presented in that decree is going to press for some sort of serious and resolute response on the part of the Jews when the plot is unveiled to be to the prejudice of the king's wife, Esther. Right, were it less than a sealed decree, it might have been canceled without reciprocal bloodshed, right? It wouldn't have been irrevocable. It was something less, but it's irrevocable. And so the king is going to have to do something more to allow the Jews to protect themselves. So it's the authoritative seal that's going to bring about the necessity of giving the Jews the right to fight back to the utter routing of their enemies. Now, surely at this point, Ahasuerus, Xerxes, does not have this anywhere in view. This is not, as we might say, on his radar, right? It's not something that he's picking up. He's not seeing it. And so truly then, we can say with Solomon, as Solomon says in Proverbs 21:1, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, as the rivers of water. He turneth it whithersoever he will. This is a story of providence. The king isn't anticipating any of this. The king couldn't possibly foresee where this is all going to lead. It's only because we have the book and we've read to the end that we know the end of the matter from the beginning. But he doesn't know. He has no idea. He's not part of the plot or the plan at this point. Now, the urgency of Haman, the urgency of Haman is seen in that this plot, and we're going to see this more in the next few verses, the plot was to be executed as soon as possible, except for one thing. He has, through his casting of lots, been constrained by his own reading of the lot to wait until the last month of the year. And, of course, he thinks that this is a providence that's going to favor himself. But he's still eager, and his purposes have to be published with all haste. And so he quickly gathered together all of the royal scribes, anyone he could, anyone that would be helpful in this. These scribes are people who are, in fact, learned not only in the languages of the empire, but they are also going to be learned in composition, legal composition. They're going to be able to compose the legality of the document. They're going to put it in the proper terminology, both from the point of view of Persian legalese and yet intelligible in the language and tongue of the various peoples throughout the empire. That's what these scribes are there to do. So the sealed decree is going to be transcribed into dozens and dozens of copies, maybe hundreds, and each of them translated as needed into the language, the idiom of the various populations scattered throughout the empire. So not only do we have 127 provinces, but we also have all the different subdivisions, and many of them are going to be speaking different languages or dialects, and all of this has to be taken into account. And all these decrees are going to be written, and each one will be sealed with that signet ring, and that's in order to demonstrate that the authority of these copies has, in fact, issued from the royal throne. And furthermore, there are going to be specific copies that are going to be transcribed, translated, to give to every local ruler, governor, or tribal leader. This is a very thorough publication that is in view. This was a decree meant to be published and understood then by every rank or class, every ethnic or national group, in every province or region of the empire. Now, in this, I think we can compare what they're doing here, what we might call the open purposes of the devil. And we might compare this with what the papists did with the Word of God, right? I mean, here, when the devil wants to make known his purpose, his wish to seek the destruction of Israel, look at the lengths to which he goes to make sure that they get those commands in their own language, in their own tongue. And on the other hand, the papists who say that they're on God's side, who say that they wanted to build up the church, that they were seeking the security of the church, instead they sought to keep the Word of God locked up in what was for most people an unintelligible language. That's truly devilish. And so at the time of the Reformation, the people of God had been kept in ignorance as to the divine purposes, and that that really, because the papists were, whether consciously or not, they were hindering that knowledge from going forth, not to the security of the church, but to the detriment of the church. And that's actually, in some sense, more devilish than what we see going on here with this decree of Haman's that's being transcribed and sent forth. We see the same kind of devilish intent in the various cults that are very quick to have all of the, you know, the Book of Mormon and the literature of the Jehovah's Witnesses translated into all of these different languages and sent into all of the world. It's important then that we have the Bible translated into the languages of the people that they can understand. But that aside, let's go back to talking about what's going on here. All of this that's going on ought to beg our attention. Here's a picture then of the care whereby a heathen king makes known his will to his people. And this decree, as we're going to see, is not merely a suggestion, but it's a binding order to be obeyed by all those who would be accounted loyal subjects. Of course, the Jews have already been declared disloyal and rebellious. So there's no expectation that they're going to receive his word with joy or that they're going to be inclined to yield it any kind of obedience. Nonetheless, as Solomon observes in Ecclesiastes 8:4, where the word of a king is, there is power. And who may say unto him, what doest thou? Now, if this seems to be the case with a heathen monarch who is only ruling according to the providence of God, not by his precept, how much more ought the people of God to give first place to the word of God, the word of the one true king? Finally, we ought to recall that this chaos that is being unleashed upon the Jews is being unleashed upon them on the eve of the Passover, 13th of Nisan, 13th of the first month, the very time when their thoughts should have been turned to the redemptive mercies of God and its implications for a sanctified obedience. We see that this threat of annihilation is being held forth. So we can see in this that the intents of the devil and his slaves run contrary to the salvific designs of the true God. And I think we can derive from this that when our salvation is actually nearest, it's at the very time, that very time, that the devil and his evil works are trying to subvert the comfort of the people of God. So the closer you are, the more you're going to be hassled, the more you're going to be threatened, the more the devil is going to come along and rattle his cage at you. Because you're not the one in the cage, he is. All of this then should remind us of our great danger in this world apart from the grace of God. So let's look at verse 13. And the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. The letters were sent. They've been drafted, they've been composed, the various copies of the decree of Haman have been written out, but it remains now for these copies to be distributed to their intended parties, provinces, regions, etc. The word letters appears here in the Hebrew without a definite article. And it has been suggested that's because it expresses a focus on the contents rather than on the letters themselves. These are letters or dispatches which speak of the destruction and pillage of the Jews. Now, in conjunction with this non-articled noun, the verb used here, translated were sent, is a nifal infinitive absolute. It's passive, but it's an infinitive absolute. And what this does, this verb is placing the whole emphasis upon the action without regard to either the agent or the circumstance of that action. So the idea is that we have letters, we're concerned with the contents, and they were sent. They were, in fact, as we're going to see, authoritatively dispatched. We're to understand these letters are dispatches, copies of the decree. They didn't disperse by normal channels or means. Rather, they're purposely dispatched throughout the empire. Sending implies agency, and that agency reminds us of the royal origin and what we would call the provenance of these letters. Furthermore, Haman has not sent these letters out on his own initiative or on his own authority. But he's done so with the express consent of the king and the king's seal, that signet ring, the seal from the signet ring, that proves he's doing it with the king's authority. So these are what we would call royal missives. And they're portrayed here as containing within themselves their own carriage or conveyance. In other words, the reason for this nifal infinitive absolute is there's something about the word of a king that carries it. Right? The fact that the content arises and is established by the authority of the king is enough to guarantee its conveyance. You don't need to know anything more about how. If you know that, you know it's going to make it out. When the king publishes a law, it's going to be published everywhere in his kingdom or his empire. So they're letters meant to be dispatched throughout the kingdom, and quite naturally they are. The letters were sent by posts. Literally, the Hebrew here says, by the hand of the runners. Now these runners were stationed approximately four or five what they called parasangs. Parasangs. Each parasang was about 2.5 miles, really 2.4 miles apart. So four or five parasangs is equal to what we would call about a half a marathon. A marathon is approximately 26 miles. So if you're a runner, or in the case when they really wanted to get there quick, they would put the runner on a horseback, as we're going to see later. The fact is, you're going to run, in your course is to run a marathon every day. You run half a marathon to the next post, and then back. So that's your job as a postman at that time. Now, the Persian system of posts is described by Xenophon, an ancient pagan author, and he attributes the system of posts in the Persian Empire to Cyrus. He says Cyrus is the one who introduces this. So Cyrus is really just a couple of kings before. I believe he's Ahasuerus' grandfather. Anyway, Xenophon says stables for horses are erected along the various lines of route at such a distance, one from another, as a horse can accomplish in a day. All the stables are provided with a number of horses and grooms. There's a postmaster to preside over each, who receives the dispatches along with the tired men and horses, and sends them on by fresh horses and fresh riders. Sometimes there's no stoppage in the conveyance, even at night. Since a night courier takes up the work of the day courier and continues it. It has been said that these posts outstrip the flight of birds, which is not altogether true, but beyond a doubt, it's the most rapid of all methods of conveyance by land. So this system that Cyrus has set up is, in fact, the fastest way to get information moved over vast distances that has ever been devised. They didn't have an internet at that point. They didn't have long-distance calling. They didn't have airmail. They had this system of posts, and it seems that Cyrus is the one who devises this. Now, as I said, later it's going to be mentioned that they rode upon thoroughbred horses, but since they have the bulk of the year before the plot goes into effect, whether or not they use the horses is not stated. The fact that they're not mentioned, at the very least, I think indicates that at least at this point, there's no indication that extra speed is necessary. And when the counter command goes out, it's going to go out with extra speed. This is going out hastily, but that's going to go out with extra speed. Now, again, if we would contemplate the providence of God in the system of posts, which, when time is of the essence, already it's been established within the Persian Empire that they would have this. And by the way, it's established by who? Cyrus. And who was Cyrus? He's the one who gave the Jews permission to go back and build the temple. Cyrus, who is called specifically a servant of God, we see he's already now established something else that God is going to use for the preservation of his people, a postal system. Now, the extent of the reach of the postal system is mentioned in the next clause. The letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces. So the postal system, we're told, was as broad as it is efficient. Stretched to the far reaches of the Persian Empire, it had posts in every province, in every region of every province, almost certainly in every town or village of a certain size. So the postal system that was constructed under Cyrus is able to transmit the decree to every quarter of that empire wherein the king desires it to be carried, and that is everywhere. Again, in this system, we need to understand the Persians had one of, if not the finest means of communicating the wishes of the palace to the most remote portions of the empire. And that's really important if you are running an empire, that you can communicate your wishes, your desires, everywhere. And again, this is going to prove to be of utmost importance when it comes time to reverse the decree of wicked Haman to the extent that they can. Now with that, the contents of the letters now follow. Right? The contents, which is where the emphasis was at the beginning of the verse, is this. To destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish. Now, this is the first three of four ends that were given in this verse, which were sought in the decree. There are four ends, but there are three listed, and then one is listed at the very end. And I want to talk about why that is. The first, to destroy. According to the rabbis, this word is used because what was sought first of all was the spiritual destruction of Israel. And so, to that end, they assert that Haman passed decrees forbidding the observance of mitzvah, Jewish law, and the study of the Torah, the scriptures. Now, we're not told that this is a case explicitly. However, since we are told that Haman has accused the Jews of observing laws diverse from the king, this suggestion, I don't think, is so far-fetched. And this is especially rings true, I think, if we consider the reason that the rabbis give for this opinion. They say that Haman knew that Israel could only be annihilated if, first of all, they forsook their God and would be removed from his spiritual protection. Now, that is true. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 10:8, "He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh an hedge, a serpent shall bite it." If the hedge of obedience is broken down, then the people of God are exposed to the bites of the serpent. And that's what they say this first verb is talking about. Destruction of spiritual life for Israel. Now, the second verb, to kill, is, according to the rabbis, a reference to literal physical death. So once the spiritual hedge has been destroyed, what happens? Where are we? The congregation of Israel is prey to the wild beasts of the wicked. And I think in this idea we hear an echo of the fall of man. Remember what was God said to Adam in the garden? "But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die," or "in dying thou shalt die." In other words, physical death is the result of spiritual death. It's the fruit of unbelief. And so if you first destroy the spiritual life of the people of God, the next thing that you can do is destroy their physical well-being. The third end in the decree, and to cause to perish, that verb expresses, according to the rabbis, a much broader goal. Here they say what is sought is the total annihilation of Israel as a nation. Now, this, again, I would suggest, is the overarching wish of Haman, that the Jews would cease to be a nation among the nations. So this, too, doesn't seem so far-fetched to me. What an amazing desire, in fact, it is that Haman has here. At this time, think about this, only Israel had the knowledge of the true God and the true worship of God. And it's this nation alone, which is the one that Haman wished to see utterly eradicated and removed from the family of nations. Now, why is that such a horrible thing? If his plan were to succeed, the hope of the coming of Messiah would have been eradicated with the nation of the Jews. And you see, that's exactly why the malice of Satan is at such pains to bring Israel not only to ruin, but to complete erasure. Satan can't have one Jew left. There has to be complete erasure from the face of the earth. Because as long as Israel remains, the promise of a coming redemption remains. So the letters say to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women. A couple of the commentators have noted on this that this heaping up of nouns, all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, that's a common practice imitative of the legal style of the time. And in fact, it has the effect of impressing upon the reader the completeness of the intended annihilation in this edict. Now, I think part of the reason for this language is it was considered foolishness among the ancients to kill the father for something but to spare the son. If you kill the father, the thought is, and this remains the thinking of a lot of the Arab people today and people in the Islamic world, right? If you kill the father, the son's going to remember you killed the father. And you are just, it's just a matter of time until you have another enemy rising up. And so you don't just kill the father, you kill the son. And so throughout the ancient world, it was just a matter of course that when criminals or rebels were put to death, you put to death their wives and their children with them. You wipe out the entire family. I guess sort of like those North Koreans when they have defectors. You don't want to have the seed of dissension remain. You want to stamp it out. You don't want to have that corrupt seed continue. You want to quash it. This is seen very clearly in this verse, that this idea. So the idea, I think, here is that the slightest tangential connection to the Jews, all Jews, right? It was enough to secure your condemnation and the reservation of any person, no matter how personally innocent or how personally powerless you were in this contest. If you were a Jew, however little that might count in the minds of a lot of people, if you were a Jew, you needed to be destroyed. This is really just the federal principle, isn't it? Upon which all wars generally are conducted. The enemy population is only slightly less target-worthy than active combatants. We still see war conducted this way. We haven't advanced much beyond that, as much as we would like to tell ourselves we have. And perhaps there's a good reason for that. Perhaps there's a good reason why, when we consider that God deals with people along the lines of this federal principle and has always dealt with people that way. To destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar. Now, what do we see? We see that this decree, intended for the killing and annihilation, was to be completed in one day. And the day, we're told, is the 13th day of the last month, Adar. So as soon as that day began, that was the day that was revealed by Lot. As soon as that day began, it was expected that this great slaughter would be effected with as much passion as they could gin up in the people until none remained of the Jews in any of the king's provinces. You really want to get people worked up for this. You want to get them prepared, as we're going to see. You want them prepared. This announcement then would give the enemies of the Jews ample time to ramp up, to prepare for the great murderous pogrom, as we'll see is clear in the next verse. So in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. Here we have, finally, the fourth end sought in the decree. Taking of the goods of the Jews for a spoil. It's been asked why this comes after and even separate from the other three. And I think the best answer I've seen is the one given by the rabbis. The rabbis thought, you see, they thought this was not limited to the 13th day of Adar. Rather, they suggested by placing this here at the end of this, it was to make clear that no one would lose any of the spoil by concentrating on the great slaughter on the 13th day of Adar. Right, so if you just spend that whole day killing Jews, once they're out of the way, take as much time as you need to take all their stuff. Don't stop right now to take their stuff. Keep killing them. Because you've only got one day to do it. Right? The Lot has told us The 13th day of Adar is the time to complete this great slaughter. After all the Jews are annihilated, here then is a decree to allow those who were active in the slaughter, in particular, to have free access to the property of the Jews that's left behind. So verse 14. A copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. Copy of the writing, or we might translate this a little bit more like this, the contents of the decree. What this is a verse, verse 14, is a verse showing the purpose of the preceding edict or decree. The contents, including the four destructive rules that we've just gone over, they were copied out in the language and tongues of the varied population of the Persian Empire. But in verse 14, we see that lest anyone should think that this previous verse, the way it was framed in the previous verse, that it was merely suggestive, this verse actually clarifies the intent of that royal decree. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province. See, now we see this decree to kill, to destroy, to kill, and annihilate Israel. It was neither a mere voluntary or a grant of permission. This act was neither of these. Rather, the act has the character of an obligatory one. They're being told they must do it. And that makes sense because Haman has instituted this as a law. And that law is directed unto everyone who would not be implicated in the same rebellion that's attributed to the Jews. Additionally, this commandment or this statute, because that's what in the Hebrew, the word really means a statute here. It's referring to those statutes in the Empire of the Medes and Persians. That word connotes unalterably, it enjoins itself upon the citizens in every province within the realm of the Persian Empire. So to disregard this decree would be to disregard the law of the sovereign, and as just noted, that would be at great risk not only to yourself but to your family. Because it was published in every part of the kingdom, the fact is there's going to be no place to hide. There's not going to be any oasis here or there where Jews might go to find relief. There's going to be no hope for them throughout the Persian Empire. As far as the Persian Empire extends, wherever its borders are, you're stuck. You've got a problem. There's nowhere you can go where people haven't heard what is to be done on the 13th day of Adar. You can't get away from this. Copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people. Now the verb was published means that this decree was revealed, or that it was made public. Being published then meant in all likelihood that it was read in the public square, and moreover that it would have been posted for anyone who could read, to read it as well. The idea here is this, that this authoritative decree is publicized, and from the previous clause we should understand that that would have happened throughout every province of the empire. Moreover, being translated into various languages of the subjugated peoples of the empire, the proclamation would extend to everyone who could be reached by the royal heralds that would announce this decree in every place. Now, calling attention to its publication to all the people implies, in fact, that the decree was not simply intended to be fulfilled by the rulers and governors, but, as we're going to see in the next verse, by all who were up to the fight, so that everyone who could would engage themselves to eradicate the Jewish pest from among the Persian people. So it was published unto all people that they should be ready against that day. Here's a reason for this widespread proclamation summed up in this clause. All of these were to prepare to be in a state of readiness, especially as that day approached. By that day, undoubtedly, we should understand the 13th day of Adar, the last month of the year. Now, the word used here for a state of readiness, or that they would be ready, actually connotes a preparedness to assume, in a sense, what destiny is bringing them. To be prepared to enter into destiny. That's the idea in this word. And of course, at this time, even for the Jews, it would probably seem like destiny was smiling upon the heathens. It's quite likely that the various peoples would be preparing to array themselves on the side of the king with great hope of acquiring at least some part or some piece of the plunder when the slaughter was finished. It's not a very good time to be a Jew in the Persian Empire. Finally, in verse 15, we're told the post went out being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. The city Shushan was perplexed. The post went out. Literally, it says the rudders went out. Now they have a clearly established mission, which is to get this edict published throughout every province and every people. And so the runners are dispatched, as one translation says, post-haste. And once they understand the need to make sure that this decree reaches every part of the empire, there really is no time to waste. So even if they're not using the thoroughbreds, they're certainly not slowing down what would be a normal process of communication. They're hastened at some point, as we're going to see. It's going to take anywhere, if you understand this system, it's going to take anywhere from 1 to 2 months to reach the farthest points that are in this kingdom. So it can't be delayed. Haman wishes to see his plot take root. He wants it to find reception amongst the various non-Jewish ethnicities throughout the empire. Of course, as is so often the case, when you have people who are subjugated, people who are, in fact, lower class people, when you have another lower class people come in, they tend to rival one another. So a lot of these people are already going to be rivals with the Jews. And this is going to prove to them to be an irresistible opportunity to express their disgust or their hatred. So he wants time, as much time as possible, because he knows it's going to take time for this terrible decree to be discovered everywhere in preparation for the day that is slated now to become the greatest holocaust in which the nation of Israel will suddenly vanish. That's his dream. It's a dream that Haman has regarding, and he's had this evidently since Mordecai didn't bow before him. The post went out being hastened by the king's commandment. What I think this means is the runners are hastened by the king's commandment because Haman doesn't want the king to change his mind. In other words, they sort of have the wind of the royal approval or approbation behind them right now, and the sooner they get out of there and get this published, the better. The sooner this authoritative decree is published everywhere, the sooner it's going to be irrevocable. Because, remember, it's a royal statute sealed by the king's signet ring, and even the king, once he's published something like this, even the king can't rescind it according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians. It's irrevocable. So Haman Haman would have been very familiar with the temperament of the king. He'd probably heard, and perhaps he'd actually witnessed it firsthand. We just don't know. The Jews would say yes, because they think that Haman is actually one of those advisors that we read about in chapter 1. That this is just the same advisor in the matter of Vashti under a different name. But one way or another, he would have been familiar with the temperament of the king, and that means he probably would have been quite familiar with the regret that overcame the king in the matter of Vashti. So he knew if the king should make strict inquiry and discover that Esther is somehow tied to this and is going to be brought into this cabal, that he might be inclined to mitigate or even reverse the decree if it hadn't yet been published. Again, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, however, once a law is promulgated by royal authority, published at large and so on, it's unchangeable and irrevocable. So this is why the need for the hastening. So Haman is pressing those runners to use all diligence to see that they carried the decree as quickly as possible, to see that it was established everywhere against the 13th day of Adar. Post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan, the palace. And once the runners are posted, it remained to begin getting this decree formally enacted. And how does that begin? We're told this decree or this statute is proclaimed in the palace of Shushan. Actually, the Hebrew speaks of the citadel or the acropolis of Shushan. Its authority was probably already known within the palace complex proper. But its authority is now published in what would be known as the central region of the capital city of the Persian Empire, that citadel that is in the center of that walled city. From there, news is going to travel quickly throughout the entire city of Shushan. With its publication in Shushan, then Haman's evil decree began to take on the character of irrevocable law. And having begun in the capital of the kingdom, it now only remains for the edict to reach the outer limits of the empire to gain formal law status everywhere, and to be understood to be that. So the post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace. And the king and Haman sat down to drink. Now, this clause, I think, emphasizes the callous nature of the wicked. If we consider that the fate of an entire nation is being consigned to the ash heap of history by this royal decree, it's hard to imagine that two people could take such a serious matter in such a nonchalant way as to just sit down to drink together. And yet we're told that both the king and Haman exhibit no conscience whatsoever regarding their decision. They give it no evidence of any hesitation or any concern or conflict, nothing of that sort. Now, as the news spread, it undoubtedly had a dampening effect upon the Jews in Shushan, right? Everywhere as they were preparing for the Passover feast. And nonetheless, the author of Esther is saying that there was a feasting going on in the palace. And at the head of that feasting, that pagan feasting, over the destruction of the people of God, Haman and the king, Haman, his chief advisor and counselor, they now relax together, enjoying, or thinking about, I guess, enjoying the coming victory over what they view as a seditious and rebellious people against whom the decree is issued. I think, in part at least, on the part of the king, it's quite likely what the king, the reason for the king's feasting at this point is that the king discerns in it, in all of this, his own wisdom. He's sort of celebrating and giving himself a big attaboy pat. Right? Because he, after all, appointed Haman, whom he now supposes has delivered him from another conspiracy, and this time the conspiracy was more pernicious, more widespread than that conspiracy of Bigthan and Teresh. This would have involved people throughout the whole empire. So the king is probably patting himself on the back a bit, saying to himself, good job, you picked a good advisor. This guy's on the ball. He's really perceptive, and he's headed off a serious conspiracy that might have brought down my monarchy. I think that might, at least in part, explain why they're so callously disengaged from the ramifications of this edict. But we're told in the final clause, the city Shushan was perplexed. I want you to note here the contrast. While the king and Haman feast, the city of Shushan, and this is opposed to the citadel or the acropolis of the city, the palace or the acropolis, the citadel, that's at the center of Shushan. But now Shushan, the center of Shushan, is put in contrast to the rest of Shushan. The rest of the city is cast into perplexity. This word perplexed means that they were cast into a state of agitation, literally a state in which their minds were wandering in confusion with respect to the news of this decree. Now, I want to suggest something contrary to a lot of evangelical commentators at this point. A lot of commentators think that this shows that there was some sympathy in Shushan, in the city of Shushan, for the Jews. And that that was in contrast to the lack of sympathy in the palace. But I would suggest it's almost certain that this last clause does not speak of everyone or even any non-Jew within the city of Shushan. Right? After all, think about this. None of the non-Jews wouldn't be affected by this, except that they were being told they had to participate in the slaughter on the coming 13th of Adar, but they're going to get paid for it. They're going to get a part of the spoil. And while it is possible, I suppose, that the inhabitants of Shushan were all confounded and filled with empathy toward the Jews suddenly, I think it seems wholly unlikely, since I cannot really think of another place in the Bible when and where Israel was pitied or the object of the empathy of the heathen people amongst whom they dwelt. You know, until God presses the wicked, they don't ever really seem to have any empathy. They have no pity. They have no point at which they're sympathetic to the plight of the people of God. I think we have to remember the words of the apostle in Romans 8:7. The carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. So I think, for me, it's hard to imagine the carnal minds of the unbelieving heathen, who are accustomed, by the way, to the wholesale slaughter of their enemies. This is not some odd feature in their society, their culture, their time. They've seen wholesale slaughter before. Why would they care much for the fate that awaited the Jews? They've never really cared for them before. There's probably nothing here really designed to make them care at all, apart from the Spirit of God working in them. On the other hand, it may well be the author attributes to the whole city the benevolent and well-founded grief expressed by the Jews of that city. Now, why would the Bible write in this way? I think that if this is the case, and I do think it comports better with human nature to see it in this way, what we see here is another clear indication that the providence of God has special respect to the people and church of God. What I mean is this. In this case, the Jews, being representatives of the true religion, the Jewish nation being the bastion of elect believers at that time, that they are signified as comprising the whole city, though they're a minority population in it. I say that because, as God declares in Romans 8:28, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. And so standing at the center of all history, the Jews and their dilemma dominates history when viewed from the point of view of God. Isn't this really the perspective of the whole Bible? I mean, think about the very book of Esther. Oh, we know a lot of things about what was going on in the Persian Empire from Herodotus and other pagan authors. But virtually none of this appears in the pages of Esther. Because from God's point of view, that doesn't count. History is his story. It's all about his people. Redemption of his people. It's their cries, the cries of the Jews, that will be heard over the rejoicing of the heathen, the wicked. It's the agony of the Jews that's going to prevail against the smug certitude of the heathen in this story. As the psalmist says in Psalm 56:8, "Thou tellest my wanderings, put thou my tears into thy bottle. Are they not in thy book?" God is treasuring up the tears and prayers of his people. That's why I think the Bible says in Adam, Paul says in Adam all fall, and in Christ all are made alive. Is it every single individual? No. But the all that are made alive comprise those who properly are the all. The reprobate are, as I heard Roger Nicole say many years ago, are nameless, faceless people. And they will remain that to eternity. So in conclusion, as one commentator has summed up this chapter, and I think he's done a wonderful job, I would like to use this to sum it up. He says, "Observe now how active everything is in this matter, and how all conspires for the extermination of the people of God. The terrible sentence is defined and described in as many languages and modes as there are peoples in the empire. But while the godly are in great distress, as they anticipate the fatal day of the cruel execution, the king and Haman indulge in drunkenness and lust and joy. So perisheth the righteous, and no man layeth it to heart." Isaiah 57:1. So the servants of God are oppressed by the agents of the devil. So cruelty triumphs, but it is well. There is a God in the heavens. With that observation, I think we should all say amen as we await to see how quickly things will turn. Because in a mere 4 days, Haman will go from the zenith of his power to hanging from the gallows that he's made for his mortal enemies. Amen.